Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Megu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hi, today my guest is Saqib Qureshi, author of the forthcoming book, The Broken Contract, Making Our Democracies Accountable, Representative, and Less Wasteful, published by Lioncrest Publishing, out in August this year. Welcome, Saqib.
Thank you very much, Kirk.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm coming from what's normally sunny Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, but it's a little overcast today. We have some perhaps a tropical storm coming up. Where are you right now?
I'm in Markham, and the weather, as you describe it, is practically identical over here as well. So we may as well be sitting in the same suburb.
Yes. I know Markham well. I actually grew up not very far from there, and have family there. So it's nice to be in touch with someone from that background. We like to start off our interviews usually by having our guests tell us a bit about themselves. You have a very interesting background, and you know, I'd like you to just tell us about your background and relate it to the book as well, please.
Right. So my background is quite eclectic. I think I'm British. I speak English with an English accent, as I keep reminding everybody. I've spent most of my life in London. My undergraduate, my PhD, my first few jobs were all in London. And then I spent 6 odd years in Dubai working in the government there before migrating to Toronto in 2011, which is where I've been since. And now I'm here. I run a real estate development firm, and I've written a couple of books out here. So that's a kind of high level of it. And I've lived in 3 continents. I've worked in multiple industries: investment banking, management consulting, government, and now as an entrepreneur. So I kind of look at things from not only a multi-geographic perspective, I think, but also a multi-sectoral kind of professional perspective, which is a bit unusual. It has its pros and cons, and that's really the summary of who I am, I think.
Okay, all right, yeah. Well, I see that you are a fellow at the LSE, And you've written for the Financial Times, Independent, the Wall Street Journal, Entrepreneur Magazine. These are in fields that would include, let's say, policy about, you know, democratic governance, but also other things as well, I assume?
That's right. So my work for the Financial Times, for instance, was largely in stock markets.
Right.
So well outside of conventional public policy.
Right, right. And I know you mentioned in your book, The Broken Contract, that you're not writing this necessarily as a political scientist or a commentator, but from the perspective of an ordinary citizen, although you're quite an extraordinary one in many ways, but from the perspective of a sort of a layman, with practical concerns rather than philosophical concerns. Am I right?
Yes. Well, thank you first for the generous remark. but yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, which is that I'm not involved in day-to-day politics. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a political commentator. I don't really harbor any political ambitions. It's very much a case of I'm an ordinary citizen. I pay my taxes, go to work, have a family, and in paying those taxes, I've come to kind of realize that things aren't really as they should be. And for many people, politics is a game, you know, being mm-hmm. part of the game, being part of the system. But I think that needs to be addressed. I think that needs to be really thought through for everybody's sake, frankly.
Right, right, right. Well, let's start with the title of your book, The Broken Contract. But what do you mean by the broken contract and why is it important?
So the broken contract speaks to an expression that at least in Western political philosophy, we've been aware of for centuries, the social contract. And it predates Rousseau, the French philosopher, though he made it very famous. And it really refers to the relationship between a government or a state and its people, that there's a contract in place, a social contract in place, where the government or the state takes taxes and performs a certain series of tasks, and in return, ordinary citizens pay their taxes and curtail their individual rights. That's the essence of it. And the reason I wrote the title, or the reason I chose the title of Broken Contract, was the more I probed what democracy in the Western tradition meant, the more I realized that democracy is not the act or the process of voting. That is not really what defines our democracy. Putting out a vote every 4 years, it has the optics of democracy, but not the soul. And the soul of democracy, I thought, was really this social contract, which is essentially we as citizens will pay our taxes, we will fund the government, and we will honor the laws and the regulations and therefore curtail some of our rights and wants. And in return, the government will perform a series of functions and it will be accountable for those functions. The government will be representative of the community and that government won't waste money. And those are the kind of three pillars I think we speak to when we speak of democracy. It's not the act of voting. It's really a government which is accountable, which is representative, and which doesn't squander our wealth. And from there, I began to kind of see the disconnection between the democracy we think we have and the one that we actually have.
Yeah, that's interesting. It resonates a lot with my own work on constitution reform and political theory and what in terms of the simplistic critique of democracy as merely a process where one votes for a government. I don't know if you're familiar with Fareed Zakaria's work in the 1990s, the illiberal democracy, and you may or may not be familiar with that work, but certainly with your experience on different continents. And for example, let's say, I'd be very interested to learn about your experience working with the government of Dubai, where, if I'm correct, the government of Dubai doesn't even have voting. Is that correct?
There's no
political system. Yeah. Right.
That's right. So, it doesn't have voting.
Now, okay. Let me just jump into that. I'm skipping over some steps here, but that's interesting in and of itself. And so let's touch on that. Would you say in a system like that, there are some elements which may be sort of holding more, holding fast better to a social contract than in systems where there is voting?
I think the governments of the Gulf region generally, but Dubai more specifically, I don't really think that the concept of a social contract in the Western tradition is one that exists out there.
Right.
So I think the relationship between state and citizen is culturally vastly different. Now, having said that, one of the odd features I found in Dubai was that there is an accountability in government, which in some instances is way tougher than it is out here.
Mm-hmm.
So government at times, not always, but at times is way more accountable than it is in the West. Not accountable to citizens as such, but certainly accountable per se.
Right. Like, for example, can you give me an example?
So, for example, I recall one instance where the ruler turned up to a government department at 9 in the morning, found out that a good chunk of senior management were late by a few minutes and what have you, and he pulled the plug on their employment.
Right.
They had an amazingly strong reason, but the idea being that if you're not going to turn up to work on time, then you're going to have to answer to somebody. And so that sent out a very powerful message to the entire government ecosystem, which was, hang on a minute, you know what? We can't just drip feed in whenever we want to. We've got to be there on time, lest it happens to us.
Right. So kind of like a management discipline sort of thing. Not necessarily a democratic social contract, but almost like terms and conditions of employment. I'm interested in exploring that because living in the Caribbean, which is a sort of liminal territory, it is Western and non-Western at the same time, and then having experience also with Asian democracies and African democracies, and thinking about democracies in different contexts outside of the West. In the 90s, there was a big debate about Asian values, because a place like Singapore, for example, there's a famous case, who I can't remember the person's last name, Michael something, and he was caned, an American citizen doing some prank or vandalism or something out there, and then people talking about human rights and etc. And Lee Kuan Yew at the time, said, we have our own set of values. Human rights may not be there, but they do have elections and they do have strong, accountability and whatnot. So they may not necessarily, follow the Rousseauian idea of the social contract, but there are elements there. With your experience, around the world, do things like that inform your perspective when you're, say, writing this book?
Consciously, I would say they didn't, because I really kept quite narrow. I kept narrow to 5 countries: Canada, the US, the UK, New Zealand, and Australia. And I wanted to focus on those 5 because they do have a more common political cultural fabric. I didn't want to delve into the likes of Singapore or, for that matter, India or Egypt, where, you know, you've got colonial histories which have left an imprint of a political infrastructure, but the culture, the kind of socio-anthropological culture, has not lent itself or doesn't lend itself so easily to that. You have to bear in mind that democracy in the West has, you know, it didn't suddenly arrive one fine morning on December the 7th, 1641. It kind of just evolved over time, over many, many centuries of fine-tuning and what have you. And it owes itself, it's married integrally, I think, to the people that it's part of. And so the point that I'm stressing, I think, is really that democracy has a culture, or at least the democracy that we live in the West has a culture to it, which is quite grassrootsy, really. I mean, for instance, it's in the West, I think democracy is deeply embedded with the notion of individual rights, at least Western liberal democracy is, whereas though that sense of individual rights is not so pronounced in India or Singapore or Egypt. You know, those countries, they don't have those traditions of individuality and individualism. There are other streams of caste, sect, which tend to have greater prominence than the individual, which is very typical of early modern or pre-modern societies, I think.
The idea that democracy has a culture and a history, I think, is very, very important. And those are things that I am particularly interested in. But I appreciate, you know, the fact that, yes, definitely your book explicitly does focus on, you know, Canada, the U.S., the U.K. And I think that there's a couple more things that I want to explore with that, too. One is an interesting remark you made, because I also have experience in those countries, not Australia as such, but Canada, the U.S., U.K., and you made a remark that Canadian democracy, you found there was more of a disconnect between, you know, a detachment and a sort of an immunity from the citizens than, say, in the U.S. or the U.K. or Australia. I that resonated with me, because I did find, you know, someone that lived for many years in Canada and has been around the world, I do find that Canada has sort of perhaps the most apolitical population that I've seen, and the culture is the political culture is in such a bubble, I found. Do you want to sort of expand on that in any way?
Yeah, I think when I migrated here back in 2011, it took a while for me to get my head around that the relationship between people and their government here isn't remotely like what it is in the UK or the US. There's very limited ownership of government. There's very little comprehension or realization that the government exists for the people, and individuals own their government. And if the government or a particular agency doesn't do its job properly, then you don't just sit there and smile at the person who failed, but you actually push back and demand an answer or an explanation or an apology. Or, you know, it's a kind of notion that, you know, over, you know, it's a lack of ownership, it's a lack of recognition. I think it's so hard to put into words, but I think the closest that I would say is that at times I thought I was several steps down a classic socialist country. At times in the last 10 years, I've worked with government to kind of think, well, they think they're doing me a favor by turning up on time, or, you know, you can't expect them to work with your deadlines or sensitivities or subtleties. So let me give you a great example. Okay. So, I'm in the real estate development industry, and I've been to a few conversations with the city officials about building things and whatnot. And we'd sometimes present a plan to do something, And we'd go to the city and say, look, you know, what do you think? And they would say, sometimes they would say, well, we can't comment on what you've just said, so why don't you put it in writing? And then we'll comment on it. And we'll say, you know, we can go ahead and do that. We can go back, employ an architect, put some bits and pieces back in for you. That'll take a couple of weeks and whatnot. But you know, if we were to do this, what would be the gut level instinctive response? What do you think? You know, and instead of trying to be helpful to the people who pay their salaries, you'll get this kind of obstinacy. Well, we can't really comment because you have to put it in writing and then we'll review. Well, I'm not asking for an official verdict. I'm just asking for a ballpark, you know, guiding sense as to how things typically play out from the universe that you're part of. You know, and that kind of speaks to, you know, that piece about being helpful, about realizing that you only exist in government because the people paid for you and you are meant to be helping them so that everybody comes out a bit better than before. That's the, you know, and that I think I often see missing. My interactions with government officials in the UK and the US have rarely branched in that direction. You know, people will feel the sense of responsibility, maybe, or you know, that we owe, or that we are at the, almost not quite at the mercy, but certainly we are obligated to citizens to put our best foot forward.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you with those observations. And, you know, having lived and grown up and gone to school in Canada, I thought about it quite a bit and, you know, traveling and afterwards. I do think that that there are some peculiarities about Canadian history that adds to that. You know, the fact that, you know, a lot of it was, you know, government based and driven in a way that, say, the US and UK perhaps were not. But also, I think in the contemporary period, I also wonder, you know, and this is more of a sensitive question, but you do sort of obliquely raise it and directly in another context in your book. But I somehow think, you know, that the immigration question may have a lot to do with it. In a place like Toronto, for example, where so much of the population was not born in Toronto or not born in Canada and coming from cultures that may not have the democratic cultures that you talk about, that, you know, democracy has a culture. I wonder how much, you know, that also may have to do with it. And you know, there are people who criticize, you know, excessive immigration into Western countries by saying Western values are eroding. And if democracy is something that is dependent upon a culture, and in your analysis of the social contract as being cultural, you know, very much cultural and not something that you can get online, as you put, or in a written document. How does that work into the equation for you?
I mean, you open up a real minefield there, because this can be manipulated one way or the other by all sorts of political camps. But I think the point that you're making, which is that immigrants from cultures which are not familiar with Western liberal traditions of democracy have their own, sorry, they bring in their own cultural frameworks and their attachments and perspectives. That's very, very true. Migration is not an overnight process. You don't suddenly leave, you know, a foreign country and then arrive in Canada as a landed immigrant and suddenly you've migrated. No, migration is a multi-decade process. It takes an awful lot of time for people to leave a home and find a new home, actually feel at home in that new home. And they do bring their historic or previous cultural baggage, some of it which is amazingly good, and some of which is not so good, and some of which is a bit of both. And so within all of that baggage that comes with them, you know, they do carry quite often, very often, a certain perspective of what government means to them and where they stand with respect to government. And in many parts of the kind of pre-modern or early modern world, or what some other people might call developing world, you know, there is no real meaningful tradition of citizens owning their government. You know, there's very limited expectations that government will listen to you. Very limited. And because of that, the participation that immigrant communities historically have had here in Canada with respect to politics has been a bit more limited, because they don't really have that much confidence given the countries they've come from. I think, so you're absolutely spot on there. And I think the other point really is that the generation next, or the children of the migrant generation, they don't really buy into that. They feel deeply Canadian or American or British. And so they kind of put their foot down and say, well, you know what? I don't care, but I am a citizen here. I am entitled to X, Y, and Z. And I'm going to now write 5 letters to my various, you know, political counselors, or a letter to the MP. You know, so I think what you're seeing is that the immigrant generation does arrive here. It takes a lot of time to effect migration meaningfully, and they do carry a bunch of, you know, legacy cultural items in their suitcase. But their children pretty much jettison all of that. They just kind of like, yeah, you know what, that kind of worked for my parents' generation. They didn't really get involved, but I'm going to get involved, and I'm not going to sit back and watch, you know, things happen that I just think are ridiculous.
Yeah. I think that's correct. I think from your biography within the book, you talk about being the son of Pakistani immigrants. And yes, I'm also the son of immigrants, and I can definitely identify with that. And it's interesting, as I've sort of remigrated back, you know, I bring, you know, these sort of Western ideas, and which is kind of foreign sometimes to the people in my ancestral home, you know, who may not have the same ideas of accountability in government. So that's interesting. So in your book, we've been exploring this idea of the social contract, because philosophically, I think it's interesting, and you know, it's something that's debated quite a bit, but I think that basically, if I understand you correctly, that you know, you talk about the social contract as largely being a sort of cultural I don't know if the word construct is the right thing, but a cultural product, let's say, of the West and something part of it, and so accountability and representation, it's part of the relationship, and a sort of an expected relationship between government and citizens. So am I right in understanding the way you have laid out, you know, what the social contract means?
Yes, I think I would just go one step further, actually, to kind of articulate the point that when we talk of democracy, in essence, I think what we're talking of is the social contract, and what we're not really talking about is the aesthetics of voting. I think the fact that a huge number of citizens in the West do not exercise their right to vote, but still expect their democracy speaks to my point, which is that democracy, or people power, which is the simplest way of translating it, people power is not the same thing as the exercise of voting every 4 or 5 years.
Okay, good.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one thing that struck me with your perspective as well in going through, I mean, as I said, it's a very pragmatic book. It's not necessarily a philosophical book, and I'm probably making you delve into philosophy. I don't know if more than you might want, but these things intrigue me. And I find that it's interesting. You're almost in some way like an old-fashioned, optimistic, gradualist reforming liberal who has a fundamental faith in the system and its reformability. And I'm just saying that because, you know, in so much of the literature and so much of the spirit of the age right now, you know, of Black Lives Matter, iconoclasm, and tearing down statues and questioning the past, and populism and demagogues and existential angst and black swan events like pandemics and fears of environmental collapse and cataclysm and disgust with the establishment from both the right and the left. You know, there are all these huge fundamental critiques of the system itself, you know, that's, you know, is a big part of the discourse in a way that hasn't been for a very long time. But you kind of hold on to this faith almost, if I may put it that way. You can obviously respond if you think I'm mischaracterizing it. But you know that the system is reformable. It doesn't need radical change. If you just make these strategic tweaks, we can actually make it much better. Am I understanding you correctly? And if so, could you elaborate on it more? Because I think that very point itself is interesting.
I think you're spot on. And the reason I've gone for more elaborate tweaks than an upheaval is upheavals are hard to start and even harder to manage. So you've got a challenge there in terms of actually getting things off the ground. Too many upheaval movements are based on a critique without offering a set of solutions, you know, a meaningful set of steps that people en masse can feel comfortable in taking. There's no point, you know, critiquing A, B, C if you don't have some kind of solution set which people can move forward with. And I've long since learned that you really can have very significant change by very small tweaks. You know, you don't need to break down every structure that we've created and start from scratch, which I think would be an impossible exercise. I think you can get to the promised land by making small tweaks to the system, which are not particularly legally or economically taxing, but get us to where we want to get to. And I think that's really my having a few more gray hairs than many of the people who are thumping the streets and demanding change. I think the fact that I've been through businesses and organizations which have needed changing and which have wanted to improve and kind of not moving towards ripping everything up in those organizations has led me to believe that, yes, you know what? You don't actually have to burn the house down to fix it. You can fix the house without burning everything down. And I think in our particular case, we have one advantage that previous generations didn't have in effecting many of the solutions that I'm suggesting, which is technology. We've got information technology at a quantum and at a depth that we've never had before. You know, we can leverage off that to get us to where we want to get to in a way that 50, 100, 200 years ago was unthinkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Sorry, did you want to continue?
I just took a swig of my Tim Horton coffee.
All right. Yeah. Oh, Tim Horton. Yeah, very Canadian. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, so in your analysis, you focus, you hone in, you know, the bulk of your book is addressing what you see as the three major problems. It's in the title of your book itself, the subtitle, waste, you know, representation and accountability, that these are the problems. So again, I suppose this is my last philosophical question here, but is it that you think that the sort of deeper existential critiques that we're seeing from almost every quarter in Western democracies at the moment, do you think that they are essentially mistaken, that there isn't really an existential problem, but it's really at this level of waste, representation and accountability? Or do you think they're kind of parallel problems that you have these problems of waste, representation and accountability, and the existential problems, you know, may be there, and we'll have to sort of deal with them later, you know, on questions of race, identity, culture, you know, the foundation of Western values. It's, you know, all those things that other people have brought in. We can deal with that later, but that, you know, these questions are of representation, waste, and accountability. You're just dealing with them in a sort of compartmental way, that this is important and you want to focus on that? Or is it that you're saying, you know, those deeper existential problems, you're actually making too much of that? That's really, once we deal with these three things, you're going to see that those problems are not as big as you thought. I'm just interested in the way you conceive of it.
I don't want to put out there a solution set for a set of political problems which are in vogue. Black Lives Matter is in vogue. It wasn't popular 5 years ago. It will not be popular in 5 years' time, is my best guess, but who knows? Mm-hmm. And so if we take Black Lives Matter as a movement, how would it fit in with the three pillars that I've pushed for? I think if we have an accountable and representative government, the Black Lives Matter movement wouldn't matter. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure if there are many major political problems that would not be resolved if we had democratic government. I don't think what we have is democratic. I don't think, you know, I mean, democratic as in people power. The people are not in power in government in Canada, in the US, or the UK, or New Zealand, or Australia. The people are not in power. And as a result of that, we have all sorts of political volcanoes erupting up once in a while. And that's going to be, I think, a deeper, faster, and more painful reality for us because of the internet. We're able to galvanize, we're able to share, we're able to spread information in a way that we couldn't do 20, 30, 40 years ago. And the rate at which we are moving is so much faster than it was before as well as a society. We can respond to events in Tokyo that took place 30 minutes ago, which a century ago was like ridiculous. So we are moving at a much faster pace. And unless we begin to put our thinking hats on in terms of, okay, what is wrong with our political system? You know, where is the democracy? Where is the people power in this? Where is that accountability? Where is that representation? And where is that efficiency of tax dollars? I think we're just going to end up with Black Lives Movement being replaced by some other movement in 24 months and another one in 24 months after that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So in a sense, you're kind of inverting the understanding, whereas, you know, people would have, you know, say that the fundamental problems are the things that, you know, Black Lives Matter are talking about, but you might actually be saying, no, that's actually symptomatic, that and if it's not Black Lives Matter today, it's going to be something else tomorrow. It might be Trumpism, it might, or something, that and that really all these are sort of results of the lack of representation, the lack of accountability, etc.
Black Lives Matter. I think I don't view their movement or the movement as an existential movement. I mean, if you're going to try and break this down at the level of existentialism, I'd be saying that the problem there, not a political problem or a government problem, but the problem there would be not so much that Black Lives Matter, it's just that we've lost focus that human identity is more important than any identity that we have. It's, you know, we are first and foremost human beings, and then we may be pink-haired or lesbian or, you know, Chinese or whatever else, but first and foremost, we are humans. And this is a thing, this is a point that I actually kind of flirted with in my first book, Reconstructing Strategy, which is this notion that we often look at other people through subhuman identity lenses. We all say that person's, you know, Jewish, that person's a football player, that person's a physician, that person's an owner of a Ferrari, you know, as opposed to actually that person is first a human being. And from there, that, you know, once you have that existential point grasped, then an awful lot of the racial tensions that we have would dissipate. But having said that, if you kind of play into the space of public policy and government, which is really where the broken contract focuses, then I don't really think that many of the political tensions that we have today would surface in quite the dramatic way and quite the painful way that they are if we have meaningful democracy.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, you and you make the point in your book, and you you actually say that, you know, Western democracies aren't really democracies, which is a strong statement. And from my understanding, that that comes from your evaluation, your analysis, that the people are actually not in power, and that's the basis of democracy, not voting. It's whether the people are in power. So I'm interested for you to elaborate that for our listeners. And, you know, so why do you say that? What, you know, how do you justify it? And do is there something else you might call, you think would better describe the state of Western democracy today? If you're saying it's not a democracy, is it a bureaucratic rule or what? So could you elaborate, please?
So why do I think we do not have a democracy out here in the West? I think by people power, the closest proxy that I can think of that we've had has been back in Athens more than 2,000 years ago. And yes, it was very caveated because women weren't allowed to participate. A whole bunch of non-citizens weren't allowed to participate at all. And you've got slaves and all the rest of it. So I don't want to suggest that we want anything like that, but it's worth kind of reminding ourselves that the people, so the male citizen population of Athens was proactively involved in the legislature of their country. They didn't really have a choice. Everybody got together to vote for legislation. They didn't outsource that legislation. What we now have is a system, a political system that has evolved bit by bit by bit, not by design as such, but really kind of incremental historical evolution, where we have outsourced our democracy to two categories of people: one, elected representatives, and two, civil servants. Now, what's interesting about this entire representative business is that the reason I don't think we have people power, which is the less controversial expression than I think democracy, because let's face it, North Korea, Sweden, Britain, they all think they're democracies. But if we focus on the word or the expression people power, we don't have people power through our representatives, because here's what happens. Every election, four or five candidates stand in front of us and they just fire hose us with information. Some of it's a pack of lies. Some of it's some truth. Some of it's a bunch of promises. Some of it's a bit of a hybrid of everything. But we get fire hosed, and we get fire hosed even more so in the information technology era that we're in. Now, once that representative is elected, you've got to bear in mind they have no resources to themselves. They've got a desk, they've got a secretary, they've got a few researchers, and that's about it. They have no power, executive power, to do very much. So our MPs, our representatives, you know, they don't get to control government. they are subject to the party whip. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the party leader tells them what they will or will not do. And the party leader tells them what the key policies are or are not. And within all of that, then for 4 or 5 years, that individual is sat there without us having the faintest idea what they do on a day-to-day basis. Yes, they'll kind of brag about it on Twitter and they'll put the social media posts up. But do we really know what they're up to? And the answer is absolutely not. We've got no idea. And they come back to us in 4 or 5 years' time and claim a bunch of successes, again, which are beyond verification, and expect us to vote on that. Now, how is that people power? You know, that to me is like, we've got no idea what you've done for 4 or 5 years. We do know that you listen to your party whips. We do know that you have lobbyists knocking on your door. We do know that you may have personal or ideological ambitions as well. Okay. And, you know, you may be granting a favor or two in the process during your tenure, but what is it that you've actually achieved for us? You know, how have you represented our interests? What did you do to fight our case? And even, you know, you've got this massive blindness, I think, in the system that we somehow think that that's democratic. It's not, you know, it's you know, we don't even elect our prime ministers or presidents for that matter. I mean, Hillary Clinton got way more votes than Donald Trump did in the last election, both of whom, by the way, who got less votes than people who didn't vote at all. Yet Donald Trump is the US president, you know, and Boris Johnson, for instance, wasn't elected prime minister. He was chosen prime minister by the Conservative Party. People never voted for the prime minister who happens to call the big shots. So you've got these very, very obvious kind of black holes, which we are so used to that we don't take notice of. Yeah. And from that kind of regularity, we're like, yeah, you know what? We must have a democracy. You know, how can it be the case that 80, 90% of every legislature or 70% is male? I mean, most of the populations in the West are female dominant, well, in terms of numbers at least. You know? So where's the representation there? And more importantly, at the influential end of government. So I've just focused on the elected piece. Now let's focus on the civil service. 99.5% of our public officials are unelected. They are not answerable to us in any meaningful sense. They do what they do. We have really no idea as citizens what they're doing, whether they're doing a good job. We sure know, statistically, we know that it's very hard in the public sector to be fired for underperformance. And we know that the public sector staff are typically way sicker in terms of sick day leaves than the private sector. But beyond that, we have very little control. We have very little influence. We have very little ownership of the 99.5% of our government, which is permanent. So you've got to ask yourself the question that if we have so little influence through our elected representatives, and we have practically no influence with 99.5% of our officials, how is that people power? Mm-hmm. How is that meaningful people power? That to me is like, we've just elected a small constituency who for the most part have no real meaningful power, except the power to perhaps appoint their political leader who happens to be the head of the country's government. And we have almost like zero influence over the rest of the government, which is 99.5%. Now, in everyday language and media and in the newspapers, we kind of don't take sight of this. We kind of just, I mean, our focus, we have not focused on this simple reality. And I think if we began to focus on this, we'd begin to realize, you know what? The citizen isn't really at the center of what happens in government. Mm-hmm. We are almost a pawn which is played around with in a political game.
Yeah.
And that's something that I take offense at personally.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you lay this out in your book, definitely. And And, you know, one of the virtues and the strengths and the focus of your book is not merely the complaint. You make it and you make your case and you analyze the problem, but then you give very practical solutions. So for each of these problems in the areas of representation, of accountability, et cetera, you have your suggestion. Here you are, you just presented this, you know, situation that sounds, you know, where one just throws one's hands up in the air and despairs, but that's not the point of your book at all. So you want to go through the things we can do about this?
So let's just roll out a few examples of what we might consider. The first is term limits on elected representatives as well as public servants, civil servants. So I would put a cap, very frankly, on the tenure of any elected representative to, I don't know, 10, 12 years, whatever deemed sensible. The pushback that you'll get from politicians, by the way, obviously they'll be very upset because they have their job as a representative. They have a huge fundraising advantage in that for the next campaign. I mean, they're not going to be very happy with this because they'll say, why are you stopping the will of the people? Why can't the people choose me for another 4 years or 6 years? My pushback would be, because our democracy is more important. Our democracy, right. Our people power is more important than your being re-voted in. We need to have more people going through our political system, more ordinary citizens going through than what's happened in the last many decades, you know, which is really the career politician who frankly is good at nothing other than being elected and being re-elected. Now, and that in itself is an art form. Let's not push that, you know, into a corner. You know, a goalkeeper has a very specific art form on a football field. You know, let's not fail to recognize that the art of being elected and being re-elected requires skill, temperament, you know, and a certain intelligence. So, but we need to recognize that and say, well, you know what, that's a great skill you have, but we do need democracy. We want people power. We want the citizenry to get involved. So you put term limits. Another thing that I think is worth thinking about is putting every elected representative's agenda and possibly even every civil servant's daily agenda available on screen. There'll be some people who are doing very sensitive national security work and you may need to work out a mechanism to exclude their information. But why can't I see what my MP was doing today? Why can't I just see her timetable for 9 to 5 or whatever hours she was working or wasn't working? Why can't I see that on my screen? Furthermore, why can't I see what she actually achieved in that particular block? And there's no harm in saying, you know, 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. had meeting with X, Y, and Z, didn't actually achieve very much. Mm-hmm. A bit disappointed, you know. Yeah, that happens. That happens to everybody. We've all been in meetings where we've sat there for 3 or 4 hours twiddling our thumbs and figured out, you know what, this is a waste of everybody's time. So why can't we have that? And another piece, for instance, would be holding civil servants to account for delays, project delays, or budgetary overruns. You know, why can't we introduce that into the equation? And there's another piece, which is how is it that we don't fire people in the public sector for underperformance? It's harder, statistically, it is harder to be fired by the federal government of Canada for underperformance than it is to apply for the astronaut's position on the NASA programs and get selected.
Yeah, definitely.
Why can't we have a more accountable public sector, you know, a more democratic public sector than what we have now?
Right. So those are I suppose the main suggestions that you forward and elaborate in your book about the small little tweaks. You called it an Archimedean point, you know, in each of these problems of waste, representation, accountability. How do you, so you've thrown these ideas out there to promote thought, to stimulate discussion. I know you explicitly say in the book that you don't necessarily say that this is the ultimate solution, and you are happy to stimulate debate and get other ideas in the fray. But in terms of where you, how you see your suggestions moving forward, it would obviously require some sort of political will, and you'd be, let's say with the public servants, for example. That's a great idea. You know, the top 5% get rewarded, the bottom two have to be weeded out. And I immediately thought about, if I were to make such a proposal here, the pushback I'd get from the unions and a whole bunch of public sector workers, there's a huge resistance. How do you see these ideas moving forward, gaining traction? What do you, have you really thought about that in terms of pushing forward? What do you have in your mind of how we engage in this project of renewal?
So I think my thinking has been that if I can put out there, if I can communicate in our social media era, an analysis of the problems and suggest some solutions which are not specific to a particular race, or to a religious identity, or to a particular profession, or to a particular income bracket or wealth bracket. If I can put something out there which says, look, here are the problems, and here are some solutions which really in principle ought to work for a wide spectrum of society, there ought to be some traction. I'm hoping there's some traction there. Yes, you will innately have pockets of resistance. So the unions, for instance, that you refer to, yes, they are good in some cases for protecting employee rights where they deserve to be protected because of malfeasance or, you know, bad employment circumstances. But very often they will fight tooth and nail for the protection of jobs which, frankly, you know, should have been taken care of and fired and all the rest of it many, many years ago. So there'll be resistance from elected politicians. I mean, how many elected politicians want to be told or will buy into, you know, having term limits, which is a reason in the US, I think you also have a problem that the vast majority of Americans want caps on electoral spending. They want a cap, but which politician who's already got his seat and therefore has a fundraising advantage, which politician is going to say, yeah, you know what, let's put a cap on the amount of dollars that come into the system. So you will have resistance pockets, but I think if I can get out there an analysis of the problem set, which is that we don't have the democracy we think we have. We actually don't really have much meaningful people power. And from there, I can give out a good dozen odd suggestions, tweaks to how to make a big difference. I'm hoping that a broader spectrum of people will come together and hit at least a few of these on the head and say, yeah, you know what? We want to know what our MP's agenda was for next week. We want to massively reward that 5% of civil servants who are outperformers. We want to be able to recruit with the same success rates as top employers on Ivy League campuses for our civil servants. You know, I think there'll be an appetite for that because, frankly, we are all sensing that the system is no longer conducive. It's no longer there for the people. It's really there for itself in very large measure.
Yeah. Now, I'd be interested in knowing the ideas that you forward, your solutions. How much are, you know, completely original? How much are taken from your experience in the private sector? How much, say, from experiences in other countries? Because I find East Asian government very interesting because it has a lot of these elements, I think, that you're talking about in terms of accountability, even though it doesn't have the framework of sort of Western human rights. But they do have strong elements of trust between government and the population, which is really absent in the West. And people have even remarked about that in the whole management of coronavirus and whatnot. You know, are there examples like maybe from where you might have gotten inspiration for these ideas, where you've seen it being implemented, where you've seen a country being transformed, or you've seen a company transformed by these ideas? And if so, could you share them with us?
I think the private sector is full of illustrations and examples of transformation for the better through accountability mechanisms. I mean, that's, I think we've seen the evolution of that entire universe in the private sector over the last 70 odd years, since, you know, with all sorts of variations. But this notion that we can make our organization better by making individuals more accountable for what they do and therefore what they don't do has been part and parcel of top tier organizations for many, many years. I mean, KPIs, for instance, key performance indicators, you know, are not new. They've been around for decades, to give you one simple tactical tool that can be used. So there's plenty of precedent for us to focus from the private sector. Now, having said that, I don't want to be the person who goes out and says the private sector is the panacea to all our solutions, to all of our ills. I don't want to be the person who's a diehard libertarian advocate. Yes, there's a space for government. There's a role for government. It is a very, very important role, not least because it takes so much of our money in taxes, including, incidentally, the money that people who are homeless pay as well. This is an important point, I think, which often gets overlooked. Homeless people do pay tax, whether it's sales tax for their simple bread and milk, you know, or tax for their clothes. There is an element there that we have to take a huge ethical responsibility for. So the examples in terms of specific bits and pieces, I you know, you can search left, right, and center, and I think you'll find many more beyond the one that I've just given. But I think it's important to point out that our Western democracy is part of our culture, and I don't like the idea. I'm not a big fan of what management consultants call best practices. You know? Right. So I don't want to go out there and say, okay, you know, Singapore has managed to pull ABC off, and therefore we should use the same strategies as Singapore, because, I mean, like you say, East Asia has a very different relationship between citizen and state. You know. At which individual rights don't feature remotely as prominently as they might out in the Midwest of the USA. So I don't really like this idea of kind of copying and pasting things that have worked elsewhere. I think it's far more important for us to recognize the problems that we have in what we have, and then kind of say, within our social, cultural, political landscape, you know, what are sensible tweaks that we could do, that we could effect, that will in turn have a very significant impact. You know, now, to the point about whether we can borrow from within the five countries, of course we can. Canada is wonderful, I think, in terms of its stemming, in terms of its tightening the cash that the political system can receive. You know, there are very tight limits as to what an individual can fund in the political system, you know, in this country. We can't put in $10,000 per year into the political system of this country. Whereas in the US, you can put in a $5 million check and, you know, you'll be pretty assured that you'll be an ambassador if your candidate wins the presidential election. So yes, the US can look at the Canadian example and say, you know, maybe we should have a look at how that's worked. But again, I caveat that because I'm reluctant to just copy and paste across political cultures, because democracy is really a political culture.
Yeah, that's the sort of one of the central arguments of your book. Well, that's what the social contract is, isn't it? It's really an embedded cultural expectation. I'm going to put it that way. Yeah. So, I mean, I've kept you a while. So, I mean, in terms of trying to, you know, bring this to a close, I do want to ask you this, this kind of concluding question or like looking forward question again. And where do you see democracy going? Because there are, you know, a few points in your book where you say, you know, if we don't tackle these issues, you know, it may actually disappear. I mean, do you really think that it actually might, you know, disappear or morph? Or in fact, I mean, maybe I'm reading it wrong, because you do say in the book that it's actually no longer really a democracy, you know, and with this sort of lockdowns and the, you know, the loss of civil liberties, you know, many people in the United States, you know, I don't know how big that discourse is in Canada, but certainly in the United States, people talk about how, you know, these lockdowns have just sort of reversed the Constitution and whatnot. I mean, where do you see, the future of democracy? And if we don't answer the questions that, you know, that you raise and some of the solutions that you offer?
I think we are on the search for alternatives. And that search is taking us to increasingly polarized, confrontational directions. We're definitely on the search for something new. Our faith in what we think is democracy, or what the system that we call democracy is, our faith in that has diminished sharply in the last 20 years in almost every Western country. We are less enthusiastic about the democracy that we have than we've been in a long, long while. Now, where do I think we'll go from here? I think that we need to have people put out solutions that aren't dramatic, that aren't violent, that aren't nauseous, and that, frankly, don't demand a complete political and legal revolution, because all of that stuff is either too hard or unpleasant. And I think what I've tried to do really is to put out solution sets to the search for a better political system, invoking our very core democratic principles and saying, you know what? If we could reinvent the democracy that we wish we had, albeit by making small changes to the democracy that we're fed up with, that's well worth looking at. That's well worth having a go at, because it will hopefully address many of the key concerns that we have. It will dissipate many of the political and economic frustrations that we feel, without the need for chaos and without the need for a systemic breakdown. And, you know, I think one of the things that I don't really fancy, I think, is any movement that goes out there and says we have to rip up the entire fabric of whatever we put together, because that is a messy place to be in. That's a very tough place to be in. It's not going to be pleasant for anybody if we move in that direction. I'm much keener on just looking at what we have and saying, look, guys, we can make small changes to all of this, you know? And in making a series of small changes, we can, you know, have a serious impact on the gap that currently exists between government and people. You know, and I'm much more an advocate of that than I am of some of what's happening out there right now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that sort of almost answers my next question, which is to wrap it up, which is basically, you know, the message that you'd like to leave your readers with. But I think that's it, isn't it?
I think so. I think the only other thing I was going to suggest was people buy my book and buy it for presents and all the rest of it for Christmas. And all that, you know, but that would be a stretch, I think. That would be a bit of a stretch. But no, I think you know, in fairness and jokes aside, that's the nail on the head. We can fix this thing.
Yeah.
We can do it without creating a lot of noise and a lot of pain.
Absolutely. So are you working on any other projects right now?
I'm working on, you know what, I'm just keen on this book launch in a couple of weeks, yeah. And then I'm going to take a couple of couple of days off and just take a bit of a chill and we'll
Are you going to do a little bit of a book launch tour?
Well, COVID being COVID, it's kind of really got out there. So I'm not quite sure what's in line in terms of book tour. I'm not sure how things will go. I know there'll be an awful lot of electronic presence. I have a blog, drsq.com, that I'm going to have to keep an active eye on. And I don't know what's in store given the uncertainty of this virus.
Absolutely. Yeah. So our listeners can reach you. Where can you just give us that URL again?
It's drsq.com. Okay. And that's the place that I kind of post every week, I think.
All right. Excellent. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been very informative and enjoyable.
Thank you very much for the time. I've enjoyed having this opportunity. Thank you.
So once again, the book is The Broken Contract: Making Our Democracies Accountable, Representative, and Less Wasteful. And we've been speaking to the author, Saqib Qureshi. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.